This is a Rabble Podcast Network show. New voices in your head. It's Radio Free Radio.
Welcome to Democracy North, a Canadian and global independent news and culture hour featuring the top interviews and headlines from this past week's daily media morning show, w2media.ca/thisweek. I'm David Ball, your host. On today's show, we're very excited to talk about a breaking story that is causing a lot of concern on the West Coast, but also across Canada. On December 28th, a woman who was in Canada Border Security Services Agency custody committed suicide before she was being deported to Mexico. It's now turned out that she was arrested simply for not having a $2.75 bus fare. We spoke with the BC Civil Liberties Association, as well as the Mexican journalist who helped break the story, Carla Lottini, herself a refugee from Mexico, about concerns over a confidentiality agreement they some have alleged the family was forced to sign, as well as concerns over detention by CBSA. Also, we'll hear about the Olympics from Mark Smith in Toronto and concerns over LGBT rights. And Ihab Latoyev talks about the anniversary of the Egyptian uprising. It's the two-year anniversary, and there are a growing number of concerns over the military coup that ousted elected President Mohamed Morsi. All these and more.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are continue to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.
Up next, our news headlines. Our top story this week. Russia has paraded its Olympic torch through Sochi for the first time in advance of the Olympic Games, as protests were held around the world against the country's anti-gay legislation. Vladimir Putin has vowed that Russia will ensure hospitable and top-class games for everyone. But the $50 billion project has long been overshadowed by Russia's law outlawing what it calls gay propaganda. Gay rights group All Out is organizing protests in 19 cities around the world this week, including St. Petersburg in Russia, but not in Sochi itself, and is urging sponsors to break their silence on the controversial legislation. Here is Al Jazeera with this report.
Under a highly controversial recent law, Timur can now be fined if he's judged to have promoted his homosexuality to children. But Timur says, so far, life hasn't changed much.
Some foreigners think it's like the Stalin era here, that gays are being shot. No, it's not like that. We live peacefully. The law can't ban us from loving somebody.
Gay people here are as aware as everyone else that the Olympics are in town and that the Games have focused international attention on Russia's so-called anti-gay law. Protests demanding that the Russian government repeal it took place on Wednesday in several cities around the world. Rights groups like Amnesty say being gay in Russia is becoming increasingly dangerous.
It means being bullied by your classmates. It means being harassed constantly. So these are the things that people are being confronted with every day. And what these people are afraid of, that after the Olympics are over and after the international media and the cameras are gone, they're going to get hunted down.
And that was Al Jazeera reporting. Meanwhile, more than 200 prominent international authors, including Gunter Grass, Salman Rushdie, Margaret Atwood, and Jonathan Franzen, have joined forces to denounce the chokehold they say Russia's anti-gay blasphemy laws place on freedom of expression, amid a growing swell of protest on the eve of the opening of the Sochi Winter Olympics. In Vancouver, several dozen people crammed into the foyer outside Canada Border Service Agency's Vancouver offices Wednesday, delivering a petition demanding a public inquiry into a Mexican woman's in-custody death. As 24 Hours reports, the BC Coroner Service is continuing to investigate the death of Lucia Vega Jimenez, a failed refugee claimant who is awaiting deportation after being arrested for an unpaid transit fare in early December. She was found hanging in her cell on December 20th and died 8 days later. BC Civil Liberties Association, Pivot Legal Society, and Known as Illegal, are calling for a public inquiry and increased oversight over CBSA's operations. Their petition garnered more than 7,500 signatures. Advocates are also raising concerns over CBSA contracting out its guarding of detainees to Genesis Security, a private firm. Coroner Service spokeswoman Barbara Klintik explained that only once all the evidence is reviewed by the chief coroner will she determine whether to call a public inquest, in which the jury is restricted to making recommendations. But CBSA's regional director, Rosalind McVicker, declined interview requests, but last week issued a statement defending the agency's detention practices as respecting Canadian law, international standards, and providing access to independent third parties. That, however, is disputed by many refugee lawyers who say they are unable to access their facilities. In federal news, the head of Elections Canada raised serious concerns about the Conservatives' proposed election reform bill on Thursday, saying that it risks suppressing the vote of many Canadians and muzzles his office. According to the Toronto Star, Mark Mayrand also took issue with the Democratic Reform Minister Pierre Poilievre's insinuation that, quote, he wears a team jersey, meaning that he has political allegiances. In his first interview since tabling of Bill C-23, the Conservatives' Fair Election Act, Mayrand raised concerns that changes to the identification requirements could disenfranchise many Canadians, including Aboriginal people, youth, and seniors. The bill also means that Mayrand can only communicate what an election is, where polling stations are, and how to vote. Some have worried that amounts to a muzzling of the office of the chief election officer. A crackdown on voter fraud and robocalls and a new independence for Canada's Elections Commissioner are among sweeping new reforms proposed in the law. Poilievre unveiled the legislation called the Fair Elections Act on Tuesday, billing it as a series of measures put, quote, everyday citizens in charge of democracy. The changes to the commissioner's job could be the most contentious because they represent a loss of authority for Chief Electoral Officer Mayrand, who's been at odds with the Conservatives, particularly over thousands of illegal robocalls impersonating election officials and sending opposition voters to the wrong polling stations. In other federal news, after a 10-month investigation, the RCMP this week laid its first, but probably not last, criminal charges over the Senate expenses scandal. As Canadian Press reports, former Liberal Senator Mac Arup and suspended former Conservative Senator Patrick Brazeau were charged on Tuesday with one count each of breach of trust and fraud. RCMP Assistant Commissioner Gilles Michaud promised that the force would continue its work on other significant files. Court documents previously released have described RCMP investigations into two other suspended senators, former Conservatives Mike Duffy and Pamela Wallen. Brazeau and Arup are the first shoes to drop in a politically charged scandal that has dominated headlines for much of the past year. Michaud said that the investigations were carried out with rigor and evidence examined carefully before charges were filed. It was the Force's National Division handles sensitive political investigations. Investigators looked at hundreds of documents, bank records, and expense claims. Michaud said during a news conference Tuesday, if convicted, Arup and Brazeau would face a maximum of 5 years in jail for breach of trust and 14 years on top of that for fraud. In media news, the same day that Post Media downsized its parliamentary bureau in Ottawa and laid off prominent environmental journalist Mike D'Souza, as well as political reporters Andrea Hill and Toby Cohen this week, a presentation by the media empire at an oil lobby group conference has raised questions about journalistic integrity. As the Vancouver Observer reports, Post Media had a presentation entitled Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers Post Media 2013 Energy Channel Sponsorship. It suggested that newspapers would work in partnership with CAPP, the leading lobby group for the oil sands and the energy industry, to put a spotlight on Canada's oil industry. While Albertans, the presentation said, may acutely be aware of this fact, the rest of the country often fails to grasp the fundamental role the energy sector plays in building and sustaining economic prosperity. The quote continues, Post Media and CAP will bring energy to the forefront of our national conversation. The presentation went on to explain how it would link Post Media's sponsored energy content with CAP's thought leadership and stimulate conversations on social media. Many railed against the claim, the revelations, pointing to a narrowing media landscape and increasing fear at criticizing the oil sands. The chain owns both the Vancouver Sun and Province, Calgary Herald, Times Colonist, and Ottawa Citizen. Over to Australia and international news. The human rights watchdog in that country has opened an inquiry into the detention of more than 1,000 children under punitive government policies that have seen asylum seekers arriving by boat and then taken to Pacific camps. According to Al Jazeera, the probe launched on Monday will examine the impact of mandatory detention of more than 1,000 asylum seeker children being held in immigration facilities in Australia. The head of the Australian Human Rights Commission said that more than 100 children are being held in far-flung Nauru, a sovereign nation that Australia has contracted to hold camps. Many times it has been the source of investigations and criticisms from groups like Amnesty International. The inquiry will examine whether Australia is in breach of its international child protection obligations and measure progress on the issue over the past decade. A similar investigation was held in 2004 at the current country's Pacific solution of detaining asylum seekers in Nauru and Papua New Guinea's Manus Island. That saw widespread hunger strikes, including detainees sewing their mouths shut. The 2004 inquiry's report found mandatory detention of children was fundamentally inconsistent with Australia's international human rights obligations, and of those for minors locked up for long periods of time were at high risk of serious mental harm. In Middle Eastern news, Al Jazeera Media Network says that it was served with a list of 20 more people being pursued by Egypt's government in connection with a case against its journalist. Only 9 of those named on it were its staff. In a news bulletin on Wednesday, the Doha-based organization said that a list was accompanied by several former charges that were different for each named individuals. Already, 3 of Algeria's employees have been in detention since December 29th. Correspondent Peter Grist, producers Bahar Mohammed, and Canadian-Egyptian Mohammed Fahmy. New to the list were British journalists Sue Turton and Dominic Kane. And the network said that those had reported from Cairo after the military toppled former elected President Mohamed Morsi. A journalist from Al Jazeera's Arabic channel, Abdullah Al-Shami, has been in custody since August and is in the third week of a hunger strike protesting his imprisonment. British journalist Dominic Kane said he has always tried to cover events in Egypt with impartiality and accuracy, and that he was dismayed by accusations against his colleagues being held without charge in Cairo. On Tuesday, the White House called on Egypt's government to release the 4 journalists still in prison. In Sri Lanka, a report on the country's civil war shows new evidence that after it ended, the government may have covered up proof of human rights violations. Al Jazeera reports that a team of international lawyers on Tuesday said security forces had systematically destroyed mass burial sites of civilians and called on the UN to launch its own investigation into their findings. NGOs and international media have been prevented from witnessing the final months of Sri Lanka's 25-year civil war against Tamil separatists, as the government forces defeated the Tamil Tigers in the north of the country, a battle in which the UN believes that 40,000 people died. The international team of investigators said it has found evidence that civilians were deliberately targeted by bombardment and subject to other war crimes between 2008 and 2009. It said that the Sri Lankan security forces were responsible for the vast majority of the violence, including widespread torture, sexual violence, and enforced disappearances. At the time, Canada's government sided with the Sri Lankan government and refused to condemn the atrocities. It has since criticized the government increasingly, including boycotting the Commonwealth meetings there over human rights stance. And finally, United Nations news. The UN has rejected a Vatican Church argument that it cannot implement a children's rights convention outside of its walls, saying the church has placed the reputation of its institution and the protection of perpetrators above the interests of children. According to Al Jazeera, the Vatican was denounced Wednesday by a human rights committee for failing to prevent priests from raping and molesting tens of thousands of children over many decades, and for adopting policies that allowed abuse to continue, with priests being moved around between parishes and often between countries. There was not, the committee said, adequate provision to ensure that cases like Ireland's Magdalen Laundry scandal, where girls were arbitrarily placed in forced labor conditions, would not be repeated. Offenders have been moved around to new churches and locations to protect them, while putting more children at risk of abuse, often condemning children to codes of silence imposed on them. The Vatican said it regretted what it called an attempt by the UN committee to interfere with its teaching on abortion and contraception. The report would put pressure on Pope Francis, who until now has been warmly received, and that the Vatican is uncomfortable with being forced into a public debate. Compulsory reporting of cases to local law enforcement has consistently been rejected by the church, which would rather have voluntary internal measures to deal with sexual abuse. Many tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of children have been abused by the church. And that is our news headlines for this week's program on Democracy North. Stay tuned for our first interview, however, about the detention in Canada Border Services Agency custody. You're listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, online at w2media.ca/thisweek, as well as on CHLY Radio in Nanaimo, the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. I'm David Ball, your host for this week. Well, on our this week, the news broke that the Canada Border Service Agency had a detainee they were deporting to Mexico commit suicide in holding cell. It took them a month to admit them information to the public. And after the story broke, the BC Civil Liberties Association raised concerns calling for an independent inquest, as well as oversight over the CBSA's detention facilities. I spoke this morning, Thursday, with Josh Patterson, the executive director of the BCCLA, as well as Mexican journalist Carla Latini, who helped break the story in 24 hours. Here they are. Good morning, Josh.
Good morning, David.
And good morning, Carla.
Good morning, David.
Thank you so much for joining us. This story has been costing me a lot of sleep, but I can't imagine how it's been for Lucia Vega Jimenez's family. Carla, can we start with you? Could you tell us what do you know about Lucia and her situation?
Well, at this moment, thanks to the Canadian press, I have a little more information. But David, what I know is what I found at the beginning, that she lost her life and she attended by to herself because she was in very, very high level of despair while she was in a detention center in the Vancouver airport.
So, and she was about to be deported to Mexico, as I understand.
As I understand, yeah, she was close, but instead of that, she committed suicide. So I think it speaks well by itself. I mean, I'm going to repeat my own words. What kind of country is Mexico that she didn't want back to Mexico and she preferred to attend against her life, to commit suicide? I mean.
Josh, I wondered if I could ask you. You've put out a couple statements about her death, and could you say exactly what are your concerns about what happened, and what would you like to see?
Well, we have a lot of concerns with what happened here. Obviously, any death in custody is a tragedy, especially where it appears that perhaps that death could have been prevented. So we have a lot of questions. First of all, what was done in relation to the death of Ms. Vega Jimenez? Could that death have been prevented? Why was it that we've heard the allegation that, 45 minutes passed after she tried to hang herself and she wasn't attended to medically? Why was it that... it took a month for this news to creep out, and credit to both of you, Carla and David, for your role in bringing this to light with the public. It should not have been left to activists and journalists to bring this information to light. CBSA ought to have disclosed that someone had died in their custody immediately. So we think that's completely unacceptable. We've also heard reports, and I know that Carla has spoken of this, having spoken with people who have said there were some kind of confidentiality agreement entered into by a member of her family with CBSA. I mean, if that is true, what is going on here? I mean, this starts to look a bit like a cover-up when the agency doesn't release the information to the public. There's confidentiality agreements, potentially unconfirmed, to keep family members silent. The whole thing just sounds terrible. And so what we are asking for, and it's something that's a problem much more broadly than just in this particular case, is that there needs to be independent oversight over the activities of Canada Border Services Agency. If this had happened with someone in custody of the RCMP, there would have immediately been an independent civilian investigation. Same goes for any of the municipal police forces in British Columbia. Same goes with the provincial police force, for example, in Ontario. Why is it that this police force does not have an independent civilian oversight body to investigate these kinds of tragedies?
No, I've spoken with Canada Border Services Agency, and they've said that they haven't replied to the allegations about this confidentiality document, but they do say that they have oversight from groups like the Red Cross and that they are cooperating with the investigation, both by the Richmond RCMP and also the coroner's office. So, I mean, what do you say to that when they say, well, we already have this mechanism and we, you know, conduct our facilities and to the highest Canadian standards of detention?
I say a few things. We're pleased that the BC coroner is looking into it. They're obviously an independent civilian body. They should be looking into it, and we hope they call an inquest. But they're going to be looking at it from the perspective of very technically what actually happened and what went wrong. They're not going to be looking at what happened afterwards. They're not going to be looking at why CBSA kept this under wraps. And they're not going to have the power to make any binding recommendations. They're doing important work, and we're glad that they're doing it. As far as the Red Cross is concerned, with great respect to the Red Cross, they have an agreement with CBSA that they're not allowed to disclose anything that happens, anything that they see. In exchange for their access to CBSA facilities, they can never tell anyone what happens. So that's no oversight body. That is not a public mechanism. There may be benefit that results from that. We don't know. The fact is, we just don't know because they can't tell us anything about it. So that does not do the trick here. And then as far as the RCMP are concerned, you know, they have said that there was no criminal activity here. That may well be the case. They may be correct. I have no reason necessarily to doubt that. But at least for British Columbia, it's been clear for many years that police on police investigation is not appropriate. That's why we've made a policy decision in this province to have independent outside civilian investigation. It's not that police are incapable. It's not that police will screw it up in every single case, but we've seen enough instances where police-on-police investigations have not led to acceptable results that we've created a different body to do it, and so that needs to be the case here.
Carla, I want to go over to you. This so far unconfirmed agreement that was allegedly signed with Lucia's sister, Martha. This was, I heard about this from you, but it was confirmed by the priest who administered last rites, who also spoke to Martha. So we're still waiting for if this was a document perhaps that she agreed to. We don't know yet what exactly was in there. It may have been some confusion about it. But what do you know about this document?
What I know is the same, that the Reverend Eduardo Quintero, he confirmed the version of the agreement. And yesterday I heard the CBSA officials, they said that this agreement is not true, that they never give any confidentiality agreement to Martha's sister. But you know what? Another lawyer said that he knew about this kind of secret confidentiality agreement. So, because I have happened for a similar situation when I signed a confidentiality agreement to not make public the corruption in Mexico, I have a little bit of idea about this. And well, this is against human rights because Lucia's sister, I barely can believe that she speaks good English, that she knows to read English. So why, if there wasn't a negligence in CBSA custody, why they have to give her a confidentiality agreement? I mean, this seems to me, I think there's something suspicious. I think there was negligence. I mean, I can't believe they are very picky with the migrants and they don't care about life and migrants while they are in detention. So what I think and I hope is someone else in Mexico can help us to find a family. And, well, we have to see more lawyers to know if they are allowed or not, if they sign, well, if Martha signed the agreement, and if she has the right, an international right, or I don't know, to speak out. Because I'm sure she was afraid. I told you, just imagine you come to see your sister that just committed suicide, and they tell you that you have to pay $3,500, and the Mexican consulate didn't want to help you at the beginning, even when at the end they helped her. So, and you don't speak the language. I mean, the level of despair of Marta should be really high as well.
Carla, you've been in a situation 2 years ago where you were almost deported from Canada before activists took up your cause and fought for it. I know that's been written about a lot, but could you maybe, for our last question, could you talk a little bit about, you know, right now the Canadian government has said that they've set quotas, over 800 refugee claimants. They want to deny their cases and to have them overturned. And that's a quota that's set annually. I think it's 845 refugee claimants that they think are false. How does this affect you as someone who's been through a situation where you were told you were not a real refugee after receiving threats in Mexico? And how do you think this reflects on Lucia's death?
Oh, well, David, I should say that I am very sad. I'm very angry. It makes me feel indignant because it's human life. It's not a case. It's a human life. The family of Lucia should be really sad, right, and feeling frustration. And the process, the immigration process is a hell. I mean, it's very, very hard. And you live with stress the whole day. When you open your eyes, you're thinking to receive a IRB envelope saying if you are accepted or not. And when you go to sleep, you are thinking if they're going to kick you back to your country and you can feel you lose your life or what you're going to do. So this is very, very, very stressful situation, and it's indignant because we're humans, and we're not here for holidays. We're here because we need to. I mean, if Mexico were if Mexico will be a safe country, we don't like to leave our family, our roots, our food, our friends. I mean, we won't be here, David. We're here because we need to. And those immigrants are human lives and have a family and have a right to look for a better life. I mean, Mexico is not a safe country, no matter if the immigration minister of Canada is saying it's safe. It's not safe. It's very violent, and it's in a silent war right now and since a long time ago. But they just don't want to accept this. Maybe for convenience, maybe for the mining, maybe for the NAFTA agreements. I don't know. But it's not safe, and the level of despair is so high. And, I promise you, I was telling yesterday to a journalist, for holidays, my country, and I don't want to be rude with this, but it's true, David. We're not here for holidays, and I'm sad because we have that fame about Mexican or bogus refugees. People is running from Mexico because it's very violent. It's very corrupted. People in this election, they made an electoral fraud. This guy was imposed. So people is not happy. And no matter if they put big walls to supposedly detain immigration, Mexicans, as many people from the world, will be running from their countries.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Carla. Josh, any last thoughts from you in terms of what likelihood you think there is of finding the answers in Lucia's case?
Well, I'm very hopeful, of course, that the coroner will get to the bottom of some answers as to exactly what happened to lead to her death. But we have a great deal of concern about what kind of answers we're going to get about how CBSA behaved, not only leading up to her death, but in the aftermath of her death. This is just a tragedy. It's evidence potentially of a horrible problem at CBSA in terms of accountability. And like I said, it's not just this instance. There have been many, many allegations of misconduct and problems with CBSA right across the country. This latest tragedy only serves to highlight that there needs to be an independent oversight body for this police agency. It cannot just continue to run its affairs on its own, and you have to complain by email using their website if you have some problem with what they've done.
Well, thank you so much, both of you, for joining us. It's an honor to talk to you, and sorry it's under such sad circumstances, but hopefully it will lead to some kind of change.
Thank you, David.
Thank you,
Carla.
For you, David.
Thank you. That was Carla Latini, a journalist originally from Mexico who fled to Canada 2 years ago, and Josh Patterson, executive director of the BC Civil Liberties Association. Listening to Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM, as well as on CHLY Radio Nanaimo, the Rabble Podcast Network, and on iTunes. You can find us on w2media.ca/thisweek. Well, for our next interview, we have some coverage of the Olympics that are coming up, but they've raised increasing numbers of concerns from advocates for LGBT communities, as well as about human rights. On our program on Tuesday, Erwin Ostindy interviewed Mark Smith in Toronto, who talked about some of these concerns about the Olympics as we head into them. Here is Mark Smith, interviewed by Erwin Ostindy on our program on Tuesday.
Views that, of course, as we heard this week, there's no gay people in Sochi. Interesting that there's a gay club in Sochi, but apparently there's no gay people in Sochi. But to bring more clarity to this confusing situation, we have Mark Smith on the line from Toronto. Good morning, Mark.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us. Well, you're no stranger to monitoring and looking at the Olympics. You were here in Vancouver for the 2010 Games, and interesting, you know, some tiny steps forward and bigger steps back. This week, the Canadian Olympic Committee announced their women's ski jumping team. What did you think of that announcement?
That is pretty cool. When in Vancouver, I think we're all sort of part of the lobbying to get that to happen, which was pretty fun to watch. I really didn't think it was going to happen. Usually it takes many, many years of lobbying, but having a women's ski jumping team is a big step. It happened so quick. Thank you, Vancouver.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, the Olympics are still fraught with their McDonald's and Visa and the whole extreme corporatization of these games and the usurping of billions of dollars of public resources for these development projects. But at the human level and at the public awareness level, there are also some positives and revealing the inequity in some small things like the fact that ski jumping was only something that men could do. Breaking that. And as you said, the lobbying of largely a group of American women during 2010 and the embarrassment that they caused the Olympics in 2010, saying that, in fact, they even came to court in Vancouver in 2009 and lost that court case. The court said they didn't have jurisdiction, but that's a move. But let's move over to Russia. You've been following the situation around the gay and lesbian rights, LGBT movement around the world and advocacy work that's happening. And a lot of it is happening around the Sochi Games. And obviously, queer rights is something that is not about the Olympics. It's a universal struggle. But how do you see it really crystallizing during this 2014 Olympic Games?
I wish I could predict that. This is going to be interesting. I think, as I said before, Putin is setting up a scapegoat. And any failure, even if there are terrorist attacks, is going to be an anger outlash. Any failure, any terrorism that happened, he's now opened the door for it to be legal and right and just to attack anybody who's slightly different because they're gay. So I think at this point right now we're pretty much at a lose-lose situation. So how do we turn that around? How do we make it work better for us? How do we make sure the COC and the IOC are ensuring that all human rights are paramount to any country that bids? That's for me, that is one of my focuses, is trying to make sure that we keep reminding them, and that's where you go to the Coca-Colas. who I'm extremely disappointed in right now, and the McDonald's and stuff like this. How do we keep reminding them that that human rights are paramount to anybody being able to perform as a sports person?
The Putin has said that that Russia is not anti-gay and that he's not anti-gay. He says it's only his actions are only meant to be restricting the propaganda, quote, the propaganda of pedophilia and homosexuality among children. He said the Russian law was designed to, quote, protect children and future demographic development, and if that gay people were successful, he wished them all the best. He said when they achieve great results, such as, for instance, Elton John achieves, who is an extraordinary person, a distinguished musician, millions of our people sincerely love him with no regard to his sexual orientation. What do you think about that, the contradiction of what's really happening on the ground?
Well, he was part of the whole communist double-speak, say one thing, do something else.
I don't think that's limited to communists, but...
Yeah, I know. I was just...
But in terms of the Soviet...
Pictures of Harper were just flashing through my head as I was saying that, too. But it's just sort of... Yeah, it happens all the time. They say one thing, do another. I mean, he's completely opened the door to permission to demonize mm-hmm. gay people. And just the common sense and common knowledge show that there's absolutely no link between pedophilia and homosexuality. Mm-hmm. There's more incidences of family members, opposite sex incidents. So it's like he's really good at not stating the facts.
Yeah.
Just by saying what he did, he's still linking it. I mean, I'm oddly still furious at the Grammys from two nights ago. I mean, Madonna came out sang beautifully to couples that just got married, but the television broadcaster insisted that every time they got close to kissing, they cut to something else. There was no consummation. Per se, like any marriage is usually you may kiss the, and the broadcast didn't do that. It's still happening here. It's just like little things like this that completely negate any inequality.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Olympic Games, the official figures for spending on Sochi have been put at about $51 billion, four times the planned cost and more than either the London, the Beijing, Vancouver Olympic Games.
Yeah.
One critical report puts the corruption estimates at $30 billion. You mentioned that you fear that the gay and lesbian community in Russia will be used as a scapegoat. How is this global solidarity with the Russian gay and lesbian community happening? What do you see in the media and through your networks?
There are. The activists within Russia are being very cautious. They know something's coming their way. Of course, there's a million different minds of what needs to be done, even here in Toronto, as we're organizing for 10 straight days of awareness campaigns to go through the Olympics. Actually, more than that, I was just talking to Pride House, and they're looking at even 5 days into the Paralympics, keeping the momentum going. It's difficult. It's difficult for them because they are being put in danger. You're getting the brave ones that are standing up and waving a flag in Sochi already, and of course getting arrested. From what we've been told, there are safe houses being set up in the areas in Russia. They're looking at opening a Pride House after the Olympics in Moscow, just so that they can safely do it. So that when the security forces are not focused on things anymore, they feel like they can relax a little bit. There's plenty of actions. Like here in Toronto, we've got Pride House. We've got organizers doing significant protests and rallies and everything starting the day before the Olympics. A lot of people are ensuring that Uganda and other places are not forgotten. So it's adding momentum to the whole gay rights movement here in North America. I know in Germany and all throughout Europe, which is good. Get some refocus. hard to predict. Like I said, hard to predict exactly what's going to happen in Russia, though.
And that was Mark Smith, interviewed by Erwin Ostendi on our program on Tuesday.
I'm your host, Jahan Zib, and my co-host, Derek O'Keefe.
Yeah, thank you, Jahan Zib, and we're very happy to have a return guest on the line, Ihab Lotayef in Montreal. Ihab is an Egyptian-Canadian organizer and activist, has been involved with the Boat to Gaza and Gaza's ARC projects, and we've had him on the program to talk about that. And last year we had him on the program to talk about actually some quite serious harassment he was suffering from Canadian intelligence services related to his activism for democracy in Egypt. And Ihab has recently been part of founding the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy, raising awareness of the ongoing struggle for democracy in Egypt. And he's on the line today to talk to us about the third anniversary of the uprising that overthrew Mubarak and the current situation on the ground in Egypt. Good morning, Ihab.
Good morning.
It's always a pleasure to have you on Media Mornings and to speak with you. Although today we had, very difficult news to report off the top, a wave of suicide bombings in Cairo. I guess we should just start with your reaction to these bombings and their timing a day before the anniversary.
Well, if you want to start from there, then I will just start bluntly and say, with the situation in Egypt, what it is, and with the government of Egypt or the regime in control in Egypt acting the way it is right now, everything is put in question. The motivation, who is behind anything, I'm not pointing fingers here, but it's very important to see that they are using these incidents in a way to continue the path of non-democracy and the path of shoving decisions in people's throats. One has to think who benefits from these things before we start believing whoever they blame for these things.
No, absolutely. And maybe just to step back, tomorrow is the third anniversary of the January 25th movement that ended up overthrowing Mubarak and led to a big opening for democracy in Egypt. It's sort of hard to believe it's only been 3 years, but so much progress and then so much regression and repression, especially over the last 6 months. How did we get to this point? And, are things now worse than they were 3 years ago before Mubarak was overthrown? It just seems a very dire situation there in Egypt.
Yes, I believe things are worse right now. I think that the Mubarak regime, in the end of its days and the end of its years, probably had realized that it had to compromise and play nice and try to show that there are openings in the system and try to, reach out to, in some ways, all artificial. I'm not saying that any of it was real, true movement towards democracy. But it had became mellower to a certain extent, and it allowed certain dissent. Right now, the regime that's in place right now is not allowing any dissent, and it's using the dirty card that was played by George Bush and many others over the years of terrorism and of splitting the people, us versus them, and it's dealing with a very heavy hand with any faction that shows dissent, not only the Muslim Brotherhood, because the liberals and the progressives are getting the same treatment right now from the current regime. And how we got there, it is because really many people underestimated the depth of the Mubarak regime's infiltration into all the apparatuses of the state, being it the army or the police or the foreign affairs or the Ministry of Interior, of course, or the judiciary even, unfortunately. And all those made a turn into a democratic process really, really difficult and challenging. And a bit of naivety is what got us to where we are right now. Of course, the Muslim Brotherhood were the most prepared faction to take control, but they also fell into the trap. And the Mubarak regime, if you want to call it the Mubarak regime, because I think it's far beyond a person, the existing regime that was benefiting from Mubarak's rule, really staged a counter-revolution and took over with the help of the upper class and the business, and it became really a typical example of a class and military coup d'etat against the will of the people as a whole. Unfortunately, Egypt is a country where not all voices are equal, like most countries in the world, of course. But the media and the public sphere is controlled by a group of elite that decided to side with the coup for their own interests, and that's why we ended where we are right now. But the struggle goes on because democracy has to prevail.
And Ahab, I wanted to ask, now that the Muslim Brotherhood has been declared a terrorist organization, what avenue could the people use in the electoral arena to challenge the government? Or what? And now that the electoral arena seems to be closed, is there any other avenue the people could take within the current institutions to challenge the regime?
See, this is the catastrophe and the disaster that comes through dictatorship, that comes through stifling voices. Like many editorialists started to write over the past couple of months, when you declare the Muslim Brotherhood a terrorist organization, then you're making them see that they have no venue but to become a terrorist organization. I hope that no group in Egypt becomes a terrorist organization. I don't see that terrorism and violence can lead except to worse violence and a more deteriorating situation. Right now, I think that the playing into the current political system that is shoved into people's throats in itself is a no-go from the beginning. If we accept that this coup d'etat would become the norm and we accept it and follow in its steps, then what would guarantee us that after another year of democratic artificial, I would call, but let's say we believe it's a democratic process. After another year of democratic process, that somebody gets elected or a majority in the House gets elected that does something or acts in a way that the military doesn't like or that the elite doesn't like. What prevents them from staging another coup? What would make the people confident that their voice is worth it? I think what we're facing right now is far more serious than who do I elect. It is what is the value of my voice, and that's why we have to continue standing against the coup till it falls, because no other venue would lead us to real democracy.
We wanted to stress with you a little bit of the Canadian context. You've been part of forming the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy, and this week when Harper was in the Middle East, Harper made some what the Toronto Star actually described as shockingly callous comments about Egypt, essentially hailing the repression that followed the coup as a return to stability in Egypt. So the Canadian government, which formally recognized that it was a coup in July, sort of seemed to oppose the coup at first, but then made a series of comments supporting the coup regime, John Baird Harper. So in this context, what do we need to do in Canada to support the movement for democracy in Egypt?
Well, we need first the organizing in Canada among the Egyptian people, and I'm not going to say that there are no Egyptians in Canada that support the coup. Yes, there are. But the organizing that is against the coup, that sees that democracy has to take precedence over everything and anything, is really coast to coast. And the coalition, the Egyptian-Canadian Coalition for Democracy, has been growing in strength and growing in connection to each other and in activity over the past months, really in a healthy fashion, because we all believe the same things. We come from different sides of the spectrum. Some of us are Muslim Brotherhood, some of us are conservative, some of us are very liberal, some of us are communist or left-leanings or Nasserites. So there are many different types of people in the coalition. We all believe that our duty is to do two things. Number one, influence the public and political sphere in Canada to understand the reality of what's happening in Egypt, and that no country should accept any gains based on the oppression of a people in a country under a dictatorship.
And that was Ihab Latoyev, interviewed by Derek O'Keefe on our program last Friday. Well, that makes our program for Democracy North here on Vancouver Co-op Radio, CFRO 100.5 FM. You can check our, this podcast and all our archives at w2media.ca/thisweek. Thanks for listening.
Every weekday from 7 to 8 a.m., Media Mornings brings you independent news and culture you won't hear anywhere else.
Daily headlines, interviews, countless local voices, and our Latin America report help you make sense of today's news from Coast Salish territories to global affairs.
Guests include David Suzuki.
Media become hostages of the corporate agenda, and thank God for the independents like you.
Indigenous activists like Pam Palmater.
This kind of radio show helps inform Indigenous and non-Indigenous people and hopefully inspire our Indigenous citizens to take action.
Social justice advocates like Maude Barlow.
We are have continued to be America's gas tank, although now we want to be the gas tank for the world.
Artists like Kenny Starr.
Change is created by lots of different types of activists.
Ray Spoon.
Gender is limiting and affecting everyone.
And authors like Michael Parenti.
The state is at the service of these corporations.
So tune in to Media Mornings weekdays 7 to 8 a.m.
on Vancouver Co-op Radio 100.5 FM and podcasting at w2media.ca.